Welcome to The Science of Murder. This podcast discusses the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killings, and the science that is used to catch the perpetrators. We will shine the spotlight on some of the people responsible for the advances in science and techniques that were used to catch murderers. We will talk about how many notorious serial killers managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. We will also discuss times where science, or the people wielding it, failed in their quest to catch a killer. My name is Lissa, and I'll be your host for the discussions of the science of murder. I'm not a forensic scientist, psychologist, or legal professional. I'm just one of the many people who are interested in the topic of true crime and its perpetrators. I am curiously fascinated in the how and why these crimes happen and how science has developed to catch and convict these criminals. I'm here to open up those conversation topics that still aren't quite acceptable to the mainstream, but also ground them in my own love of science, scientific techniques, and psychological studies. I know I'm not the only one out here fascinated by the science of murder and true crime, so I want us to find each other and learn together. Today, we are discussing the science of morphine as a poison. If you haven't heard our toxicology overview yet, go back and listen to that first so you understand how the lab actually screens for these alkaloids. The story of morphine begins with Papaver somniferum, the opium poppy. The name itself is a clinical description. Somniferum translates to sleep ringing. For thousands of years, the raw latex of the poppy, known as opium, was used as a crude anesthetic. It was a messy, unpredictable mixture of over 40 different alkaloids. Surgeons and apothecaries were essentially gambling. If a batch was weak, the patient suffered the trauma of the knife. If it was too strong, they simply never woke up. This gambling with the poppy is famously illustrated in my favorite movie, the 1939 classic, The Wizard of Oz. When Dorothy and her friends are running through that massive field of poppies, the Wicked Witch isn't just using magic, she's using a sedative. They fall into a deep narcotic sleep, showing the very real central nervous system shutdown that opium causes. Interestingly, Glinda the Good Witch saves them by making it snow. In the 1930s, snow was a common street slang for cocaine, a powerful stimulant. While the movie used the winter chill to wake them up, it inadvertently staged a classic upper versus downer medical battle. The problem in the real world was that there was no Glinda to provide a precise antidote. You were either underdosed and in agony, or overdosed and drifting away. The turning point for the science of murder occurred in 1804. A young German pharmacist assistant named Friedrich Sertner managed to do what centuries of alchemists could not. He isolated the specific alkaloid responsible for the plant's hypnotic power. He named it morphium, after Morpheus, the Greek god of dreams. This was a massive milestone because it transformed a botanical mystery into a measurable chemical. Before Sertner, you had to guess the potency of a poppy crop. After him, you could measure a lethal dose with mathematical precision. This isolation allowed for the birth of the therapeutic index. To a nurse or doctor, that index is a safety guide designed to keep a patient in the window of relief. To a killer, however, the index is a target. It allows a perpetrator to calculate exactly how much of the pure active ingredient is required to push a victim's biology past the point of recovery. In the laboratory, we categorize morphine as a phenanthrene derivative and a potent mu-opioid receptor agonist. To put it simply, it is a biological master key that fits into specific locks within the central nervous system to block pain signals. But before it was a highly regulated substance, morphine lived a double life under a variety of names that reflected the public's transition from awe to terror. In the 19th century, morphine was hailed as a miracle. Sir William Osler, the father of modern medicine, coined the term God's own medicine, reflecting a medical consensus that this was humanity's ultimate gift for the relief of suffering. It was only after the American Civil War that the facade began to crack, as tens of thousands of soldiers returned home with soldier's disease, a polite euphemism for the massive wave of addiction caused by unregulated battlefield use. In the criminal underworld, the drug took on a human identity. Calling it Miss Emma, or simply M, allowed the toxin to be discussed in plain sight without alerting the authorities. In the medical records of victims like those of Harold Shipman, you won't find the romanticized names. You'll find the clinical reality. Diamorphine is the clinical name for medical-grade heroin. While the world sees heroin as a street drug, the medical system still uses diamorphine for severe pain. This is a crucial forensic distinction. When the body absorbs diamorphine, the liver immediately strips away the acetyl groups, turning it back into morphine. This is why, years later, the Shipman exhumations found morphine in the tissue, even though he had actually injected diamorphine. To understand the why of the crime, we have to look at how morphine was misused as a cover for murder. Before we fully respected the dangers of respiratory depression, it was a standard ingredient in cough syrups to suppress the reflex. For a poisoner, this was the perfect alibi. I just gave them something for their cough, and they fell asleep. Furthermore, the early 20th century practice of twilight sleep, pairing morphine with scopolamine to induce a state of forgetful childbirth, created a state of pharmacological amnesia. To a predator, this medical norm provided the perfect environment to experiment on victims who would never remember the whisper that took their lives. To understand the timeline of a drug or a poison-based crime, like the intentional overdose of morphine, we have to look at the drug's half-life. In toxicology, a half-life is the time it takes for the concentration of a substance in the blood to be reduced by exactly 50%. For morphine, that window is remarkably short, generally 2 to 3 hours. The moment a killer administers a dose, the body's metabolic engine, the liver, immediately goes to work, stripping the morphine away and converting it into metabolites. This is why a drug's half-life is the ultimate forensic clock. The half-life determines how long the smoking gun remains in the victim's blood. If a victim survives the initial dose for even a few hours, the parent morphine levels will drop significantly, but the metabolites, or the daughter molecules, will spike. By measuring the ratio of what is left against the known half-life, a toxicologist can work backward to calculate exactly when the poison was administered. This often allows investigators to pin the time of the injection to the exact moment a specific suspect was in the room. Because morphine is processed so quickly, a predator who wants to maintain a state of twilight sleep or a narcotic coma must act within that narrow 2 to 3 hour window. They are essentially racing against the victim's own liver. To succeed, they either have to give a single, overwhelming dose to shatter the therapeutic index instantly, or they have to administer repeated top-off doses to keep the victim under. But a name is just a label. To see how it truly works, we have to look at the respiratory trade-off happening deep in the brain stem. In a clinical setting, morphine is a miracle of pharmacodynamics. It increases the pain threshold and alters the emotional response to pain, turning agony into a distant, manageable hum. However, morphine acts along a therapeutic index, which is individual to each patient, based on exposure, tolerance, and overall biological sturdiness. This is the ultimate forensic challenge. A dose that kills a victim with no previous exposure, like the elderly patients of Harold Shipman, might be a standard therapeutic dose for a chronic pain patient. This is why the lab cannot simply look at a number. We must compare blood levels to the victim's medical history to prove the dose was lethal. The very mechanism that kills the pain also suppresses the breathing center in the medulla oblongata. This is the therapeutic index at work, the razor-thin difference between a dose that provides comfort and one that stops the lungs. In medicine, we talk about a window of safety. On one side of the glass is pain relief, on the other is a complete cessation of the lungs. For a doctor, that window is narrow and respected. For a killer, the goal isn't to look through the window, but to shatter it. They are intentionally pushing the biology past the point where the brain remembers how to tell the body to take a breath. We identify a morphine poisoning through the physical wreckage it leaves behind, known as the opioid toxidrome. This isn't a loud death marked by the convulsions of strychnine or the corrosions of acid. It is a systemic progressive retreat of the central nervous system. Clinically, we look for the classic triad of symptoms, describing the opioid triad, the body's way of shouting what the victim can no longer say. The first is that of a narcotic coma, in which the victim descends into a state of pathological unresponsiveness. This is a sensory blackout, as morphine molecules saturate the mu opioid receptors in the cerebral cortex. The brain's interface with reality simply goes offline. In this state, there is no air hunger, no blink reflex, and no response to pain. The feeling is a leaden artificial peace, a totally sensory cutoff that masks the biological failure occurring beneath the surface. While the victim is under, we look for the second marker, meiosis, or pinpoint pupils. If you've ever walked into a dark room, you know your pupils naturally grow large to catch the available light. But with morphine, that biological reflex is paralyzed. Even in the dim light of a hospital ward, a victim's pupils will be shrunk down to the size of a needle point. It's the body's silent, frozen alarm that a narcotic has taken over the parasympathetic nervous system. In most loud murders, the body is in a sympathetic fight-or-flight state, where the pupils are huge. Morphine does the opposite. It forces a fake rest that eventually becomes permanent. Finally, as the drug's distribution reaches the medulla oblongata, we see respiratory depression. A healthy adult takes 12 to 20 breaths per minute. In a lethal morphine overdose, this slows to a whisper, sometimes only 2 or 4 shallow breaths per minute. Because morphine makes the brain stem less sensitive to carbon dioxide levels, the body essentially forgets it needs to breathe. Each breath is separated by an agonizing rhythmic silence until the journey concludes in total respiratory arrest. While the heart is more resilient and may continue to beat for several minutes after the lungs have failed, it is pumping increasingly deoxygenated blood. Without oxygen, the heart muscle eventually starves and the biological machine finally grinds to a halt. This leaves the final physical marker, cyanosis. The victim's fingernails and lips turn a deep, dusky blue because the blood is saturated with carbon dioxide but empty of oxygen. It is important to note that in these final moments of total oxygen deprivation, the pupils may actually dilate. This terminal dilation can sometimes confuse first responders, but the pinpoint pupils maintained during the coma phase remain our primary clinical signature. While a person is alive, their cell membranes act as active gatekeepers, using energy to keep drugs like morphine tucked safely inside specific organs like the liver or the lungs. But the moment the heart stops, those cellular pumps fail. This brings us to the toxicologist's greatest adversary, postmortem redistribution. This phenomena can turn a therapeutic dose into a lethal reading or vice versa, purely through the chemistry of decay. Morphine is lipophilic. It's fat-loving. It has a high volume of distribution. This means it doesn't like to stay in the water-based blood. It prefers to hide in the fatty tissues of major organs. As the body begins autolysis, these tissue barriers break down. The morphine that was safely tucked away in the liver or the reservoir of the lungs begins to passively diffuse out, following the concentration gradient into the large, stagnant vessels of the chest. Historically, pathologists would take a blood sample directly from the heart because it was the easiest, most abundant source. However, the heart sits in the center of the torso, surrounded by the leaky lungs and sitting just above the saturated liver. If you only test central or heart blood, you are likely measuring a ghost concentration, a massive spike caused by morphine leaking out of the neighboring organs after death. This is why the angel of death was so hard to catch before the 1970s. Without the ability to distinguish between central and peripheral blood, a clever doctor could always claim the lethal reading was just a byproduct of a leaky liver. Modern toxicology didn't just find the poison, it solved the geography of the body to prove exactly where the poison came from. To find the truth of the dose, the modern lab requires peripheral blood samples. We take those from the femoral vein in the leg. The femoral vein is anatomically isolated, it's far away from the major organs, and protected by dense muscle and bone. Because there's no reservoir of morphine in the calf muscles to leak into the leg veins, the concentration found there is the most accurate reflection of what was actually circulating in the victim's system at the exact moment of their death. When we compare these results to the vitreous humor, the fluid in the eye, because the eye is its own isolated chamber, it doesn't suffer from the PMR flood, providing a secondary confirmation of the femoral results. Once we have that peripheral sample, We use liquid chromatography, mass spectrometry. Chromatography acts as a molecular filter, separating the morphine from the noise of decomposing blood, proteins, fats, bacteria. In the lab, we don't just look at a vial of blood, we put it through a molecular sorting machine. Chromatography separates the blood into its individual ingredients, and then mass spectrometry acts like a hammer, shattering the morphine molecules into specific pattern of fragments. Like a broken vase, those pieces can only be put back together in one way, giving us a unique chemical fingerprint that is undeniable in court. By measuring the central to peripheral ratio, the toxicologist can determine the exact composition of the drug, no matter what the killer calls it, Miss Emma or diamorphine, the forensic lab only sees one thing, the metabolites. Because the body is a chemical processor, it doesn't matter how the drug started. Once it hits the liver, it becomes the M3G and M6G daughter molecules. By measuring the central to peripheral ratio, we can detect the ghost. If the ratio is high, say greater than 3, we know the reading is a product of decay. If the ratio is closer to 1, we have a stable, undeniable record of a lethal dose. Finally, the lab looks for the smoking gun, 6-monoacetylmorphine, or 6-MAM. This specific metabolite only exists if the victim was given heroin or diamorphine. Because 6-MAM has an incredibly short life, finding it proves the drug was a street source or a specific medical-grade heroin. If it's missing, but morphine levels are lethal, the source was likely pure pharmaceutical morphine. However, 6-MAM is notoriously elusive. Because its half-life is so incredibly short, often disappearing from the blood in less than half an hour, its absence is indicative but not definitive. If we find 6-MAM, we have a lock on the source. But if it's missing, it doesn't necessarily clear the heroin. It may simply mean the victim's liver was efficient enough to process the specific molecule signature before the heart stopped. In those cases, we have to look further down the chemical chain at the M3G, M6G ratios to decide if the killer reached for a clinical vial of morphine or a syringe of diamorphine. Modern toxicology didn't just find the poison, it solved the geography of the body to prove exactly where that poison came from. We no longer have to guess if a lethal reading was a byproduct of a leaky liver or the signature of a calculated hit. We have the ratios, the fingerprints, and the molecular clock to back us up. But science alone doesn't put a killer behind bars. It provides the evidence, but the perpetrator provides the pattern. To see how these biological ghosts and smoking guns manifest in the real world, we have to look at the predators who believe they were smarter than the chemistry. We have to look at the angels of death, individuals who traded the God's own medicine of relief for the ultimate power over life and death. Poisoning is a tale as old as time, so we have quite a history of the science of murder by poisons and how the perpetrators either got away with it or not. The first case study takes us back to a time when the lab was silent and the only evidence was the body itself. Long before the era of mass spectrometry, there was the case of Dr. William Palmer. known to history as the Wriggly Poisoner. Palmer was a man of medicine, but also a habitual gambler. When his gambling debts became insurmountable, he looked to his friend John Cook, not for a loan, but as a target for a life insurance payout. Palmer administered what he believed to be the perfect quiet death, morphine. Cook was found in a state of profound pathological unresponsiveness. In 1855, forensic science was in its infancy. There was no reliable chemical test to isolate morphine from a decomposing body. The molecular clock didn't exist yet. The liver's daughter molecules were still a botanical mystery. If the killer could hide the vial, he could hide the crime. However, science was beginning to catch on. This case was not one in a laboratory, but through the power of symptomology. Because the lab was unable to prove the poison, investigators had to rely on the physical evidence morphine leaves behind, the opioid toxidrome. Witnesses at the trial described Cook's heavy narcotic sleep and his respiratory depression with such haunting clinical vividness that the jury was forced to see what was happening at the time of death. They described a man forgetting to breathe, trapped in a sensory deprivation that only a medical professional could induce. Palmer's defense argued that without proof of the poison, there was no murder. But the prosecution proved that the toxidrome is a signature as unique as a fingerprint. It was the first time that the clinical behavior of the body under the influence of a toxin was enough to send a medical professional to the gallows. It proved that while the drug may vanish, the way it kills remains written in the victim's final moments. The next case of serial poisoner Jane Toppin brings us to the turn of the century and a predator who turned the hospital ward into a laboratory of cruelty. Jane Toppin was a nurse, a woman entrusted with the care of the vulnerable, who had eventually confessed to 31 murders. But Toppin wasn't a quiet killer in the traditional sense. She was a scientist of suffering. She didn't just administer a lethal dose and walk away. She experimented, toggling her victims between life and death like a chemical metronome. She would give a dose of morphine to induce a coma, then a dose of atropine to jumpstart the heart, watching the biological machinery strain under the conflict. Toppin's downfall was her own overconfidence. In 1901, she murdered an entire family in rapid succession. When four healthy people from the same household died within weeks of each other, the natural death excuse began to crack. The breakthrough in the Toppin case wasn't a complex lab test. It was the clinical observation of meiosis, those pinpoint pupils we had discussed. Even in 1901, doctors understood the parasympathetic response. They knew that a natural death, or one caused by a stroke or heart failure, does not leave the pupils constricted like a needlepoint. Those frozen tiny pupils were the silent alarm that led investigators to order the exhumations. Because Toppin had saturated the victim's system so thoroughly, early chemical extraction methods, though primitive by today's standards, were finally able to prove the presence of morphine in the soft tissues. The eyes pointed the way, and the chemistry confirmed the kill. Jane Toppin is widely considered one of the first recognized female serial killers in American history, particularly within the medical profession. While there were certainly others before her, like the poisoners of the mid-19th century. Taupin's case was unique because of the sheer scale of her crimes and her own chillingly modern confession. The methodology and the psychological obsession of Jane Taupin are so uniquely chilling that we will be dedicating an entire episode to her next week. As we move into the chaos of the 1940s, we encounter a predator who used the fog of war as his primary accomplice. Dr. Marcel Petiot, operating in Nazi-occupied Paris, didn't just kill for pleasure or debt, he turned murder into a commercial enterprise. He preyed on the desperate, refugees, Jewish families, and resistance fighters, promising them passage to South America for a steep fee. Petiot's method was a chilling perversion of medicine. He told his victims they needed vaccinations to enter the destination countries. Instead of a vaccine, he administered a lethal dose of morphine. Once the sensory blackout took hold, he would watch them succumb in a specially constructed gas chamber or basement room before robbing them of every heirloom and gold coin they possessed. Petiot believed the war would erase his victims forever. But in March 1944, a foul-smelling chimney fire at his townhouse led police to a basement filled with a walking nightmare. The remains of at least 26 people in varying states of decay, lime dissolution, and incineration. The Petiot case is a landmark because it proves the persistence of toxins, not just in the flesh, but in the environment. While many of the remains were skeletal or severely burned, making traditional toxicology difficult with 1940s technology, the science of murder found its proof in the doctor's office. Investigators found a staggering cache of morphine vials and drug paraphernalia. In forensics, we call this a circumstantial bridge. Even when the body is lost to fire or time, the killer's tools often remain at the scene. By matching the known clinical effects of morphine to the sheer volume of the drug Petiot had illegally stockpiled, the prosecution was able to link the vaccinations directly to the piles of luggage and clothes found in his home. It proved that even in the midst of a world at war, the specific chemistry of a single doctor's pharmacy could still be used to track a monster. If Dr. Palmer used the blackout and Dr. Petiot used the fog of war, Dr. Harold Shipman used the most dangerous weapon of all, trust. As a beloved general practitioner in Greater Manchester, Shipman was the quintessential family doctor. But behind that clinical facade was the most prolific serial killer in modern history, with an estimated victim count of 250. Shipman's methodology was terrifyingly consistent. He would visit his elderly patients at home, often alone, and administer a painkiller that was in reality a massive lethal dose of diamorphine. He would then sit and watch as they slipped into a fatal respiratory depression. Afterward, he would calmly fill out a death certificate, attributing the passing to old age or natural causes, often even arranging for a quick cremation to erase the evidence. Shipman's arrogance eventually outpaced his clinical caution. In 1998, he murdered 81-year-old Kathleen Grundy and forged her will to leave himself her entire estate. Her daughter, a lawyer, immediately spotted the clumsy forgery and demanded an investigation. This led to the landmark exhumation of Grundy's body and dozens of others. Even years after burial, the lab was able to extract massive, undeniable concentrations of morphine from the muscle and liver tissue of his victims. Because the bodies had been preserved in the cool, anaerobic environment of a coffin, the molecular clock had slowed down, leaving the poison frozen in time. However, this case also forced the forensic community to master the lessons we discussed earlier about postmortem redistribution. Toxicologists had to account for the fact that morphine is lipophilic. It leaks from the organs into the central blood after death. To prove a true lethal dose that would stand up in the high court, they had to demonstrate that these levels weren't just ghost readings caused by decay. This case solidified the necessity of peripheral sampling, taking blood from the femoral vein in the leg to ensure the science was as bulletproof as the evidence was haunting. Shipman may have believed that once the soil hit the casket, his crimes were buried. He didn't account for the fact that the body can act as a biological safe, holding the chemical truth for decades. As we move into the 21st century, the science of murder finds a new ally, big data. In a small hospital in Nakona, Texas, Vicky Dawn Jackson proved that even if a killer can hide from a doctor's eyes, they cannot hide from the constant data analysis of modern medicine. The discovery of Jackson's crimes came through statistical cluster analysis. The hospital noticed a massive deviation, an impossible spike in respiratory arrests that correlated exclusively with Jackson's shifts. In forensic epidemiology, this is the red flag that triggers an investigation. It wasn't just a trend, it was a mathematical indication that an external variable, Jackson, likely was the cause. Jackson was a nurse who viewed her patients as difficult problems to be solved. To quiet those she found demanding, she administered lethal cocktails of morphine and mivacarium. As a neuromuscular blocker, mivacarium doesn't just sedate the patient, it paralyzes the diaphragm. It creates a state of total physical helplessness. When combined with morphine suppression of the brain's respiratory drive, the victim is caught in a dual trap. The brain forgets to breathe, and the muscles lose the ability to try. The quiet death Jackson practiced was betrayed by a loud anomaly in the hospital's records. Between December 2000 and February 2001, the hospital noticed an impossible spike in respiratory arrests, nearly all of them occurring during Jackson's shifts. The data didn't just suggest a problem, it screamed it. This is the ultimate proof of the therapeutic index. Modern liquid chromatography allowed the lab to do more than just find the drug. It allowed them to quantify it with terrifying precision. Forensic toxicologists proved that the morphine in the victim's system wasn't medicine that had gone wrong. It was a massive, calculated overdose that was mathematically impossible for any legitimate clinical purpose. From the description of the opioid toxidrome with William Palmer, to the statistical analysis linked to Vicky Dawn Jackson, we have seen the evolution of how we catch those who weaponize morphine. These five cases showed the evolution of the lab. But while some killed for greed or survival, others killed for a more disturbing reason: the voyeuristic thrill of watching the biological machine break. The history of morphine is a history of the struggle between the quiet death and the science that refuses to stay silent. From the clinical observations of the 19th century to the molecular hammers of the 21st, we have seen the science of murder evolve to meet angels of death. We have learned that the body is a biological safe, and no matter how quiet the killer attempts to be, the body keeps a record that time cannot erase. Next time, we'll go deeper into the life and specific pharmacological experiments of the woman who wanted to be the most prolific killer in history. Known to history as Jolly Jane, Jane Toppin. While we touched on her briefly in this episode, next week we'll go in depth and learn that sometimes the Angel of Mercy is just a predator in a white cap. If you haven't already, please like and subscribe to The Science of Murder to continue learning along with me. If you found today's deep dive into the chemistry of death fascinating, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred provider. Reviews help other science-minded true crime fans find the show, so I encourage you to tell your accomplices. I mean friends. To learn along with us. I'd love to hear your thoughts on these cases or any future topics you'd like to suggest. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon as Science of Murder, or reach me directly at scienceofmurder@gmail.com. I'm Lissa, and thank you for joining me for this lesson on the history and mystery of toxicology. Stay curious. Stay scientific, and I'll see you in our next episode.